spine-tingling greetings, everyone. The tunes are courtesy of my special guest, Brian, and I, of course, am your host, Tessa Morrow. Thanks for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers podcast part of your morning, day, night, graveyard shift, whenever you listen and wherever you are listening from Nantucket to Pawtucket to Fuck It, from the Colorado Rockies to the Canadian Rockies, from sandy beaches to cactus-filled deserts, sleepy villages to the cities that never sleep, and you guessed it, everything in between, it is greatly appreciated.
Round of applause. This week's city shout-out goes to
Coldwater, Michigan, Moscow, Idaho, Draper, Utah, Luamneck, Ireland, La Paz, Bolivia, and Lexington, South Carolina. Today I have an amazing guest joining me, Brian
Paoni.
A Salem, Massachusetts native displaced to Northern Virginia, has been a published novelist since 2007. Brian is primarily a speculative fiction author who doesn't know how to stay in his lane. His novels feature an array of subgenres for those readers who dare to venture just outside of realism. Love it. Another thing I love is that Brian is a police detective in Maryland, and he has been working in law enforcement since 2002. He is the father to 4 children, a self-proclaimed roller coaster junkie, a Star Wars 501st member since 2005, a New England Patriots fanatic, and his favorite color is burnt orange. In 2019, he fulfilled his lifelong dream of becoming the proud owner of a 1981 DeLorean. Now, all the music that you will be hearing throughout this episode is actually different bands that Brian himself has been in, and he's the front man, he's the singer of all of them. So, pretty cool stuff. Talented dude for sure. Let's dive right in. Brian Paoni, thank you so, so much for joining me. Welcome to Paranormal Prowlers podcast.
That was my party. Woohoo!
Oh, woo, yes. So, Brian, you are a police detective, but being in Missouri State Penitentiary for several weeks while working on your book, which we will be talking about in a while, did you at times feel, instead of being the police detective, like, instead that you were, like, a doomed prisoner?
Well, I mean, so the prison closed in 2004, right? So there's no inmates there. It's purely, they do historical tours during the day, ghost tours in the evening, and then overnight ghost hunts on the weekend nights till, like, 3 a.m., 4 a.m. So it's been closed for over 2 decades now, so it definitely has the feeling of an abandoned prison. I don't feel like there's nothing there that makes you feel like, you know, it's current, or, you know, you're actually a prisoner there, even though you can go into most of the cells and lay down in the beds and, you know, you can still kind of like interact with the prison itself. And one, there's no running water there. And two, the electricity is so sparse that there's no lights, right? So, you know, when it's 1 a.m. and you're walking around a haunted penitentiary, you forget that it used to be like a prison, you know, and so there's kind of a disconnect there other than, you know, the bars and everything. It still feels like a horror movie and less like a penitentiary, you know. So I think I was able to separate, you know, my 9-to-5 job with the author side of me going in there. I definitely put on my ghost hunting hat, you know, and left the badge at the door.
So did you, like, just tell the boys at, you know, the precinct, hey, I'm taking a vacation? Oh yeah, where are you going, Brian? I'm gonna go to a penitentiary. Did they think you were kind of like crazy?
So it's funny, because the way that it worked was, I had to go to training in Missouri for my job for 8 weeks.
Mm.
I was in training from Monday morning until Friday afternoon, right around lunchtime, was when we would break for the week. And then we'd have the weekend to ourselves, and we could do whatever we wanted. And I was there for 8 weeks. I didn't come home for those 8 weeks. And I took advantage of those 8 weeks already being in Missouri for training for my job, getting a paycheck Monday through Friday that I was in class. And then what I would do is when class broke on Friday, I would go straight to the Missouri State Penitentiary, and I would stay in there, and I wouldn't leave until Friday, you know, whatever time I need to start heading back to where I was staying for my training. So I had a hotel room in Jefferson City, right down the street from Missouri State Penitentiary. So when they would close up in the middle of the night, because they would have overnight ghost hunts, 2, 3, 4, sometimes 6 a.m., but I would have to leave when the tour guides, when the staff left, because I wasn't allowed to be in there by myself.
Oh, okay.
So I was allowed to be in the buildings by myself, which I was most of the time. Most of the time I wrote completely alone in the dark at night. I wasn't allowed to be locked on the property.
So gotcha.
While there would be like employees on the grounds, Missouri State Penitentiary is 47 acres. It's multiple buildings. So I could go hours without seeing or hearing a single other person. But when they left, I would have to leave with them for a few hours until the day shift people would then come on. So I would go to the hotel room that I rented, sleep for just a couple hours, shower, brush my teeth, kind of refresh, and then drive right back to the penitentiary and be there for when the day people were opening up. And then I would stay there again all the way until 3, 4, 5, 6 a.m., go to the hotel, take a few hours, sleep, shower, refresh, go back. And I did that for 8 weeks. That's how I did it. And then on Sunday, instead of going back to the hotel that I rented, I would drive back to where my training complex was, because I had a room at the training complex, you know, because of the training. So I was actually staying in two different places. So Monday through mid-afternoon Friday, I was in complete detective mode, training, you know, learning how to work on certain cases.
Yeah.
You know, and then we would break on Sunday, and I would drive right to Missouri State Penitentiary, and then I became an author of a horror novel while staying at the Missouri State Penitentiary until Sunday, and then I would drive back to the training complex in Missouri, and I would switch back to being learning, you know. So I had to like bounce back and forth between the two kind of careers, you know, because I take my writing career just as seriously as I do my, you know, my policing career.
Yeah.
They're both as equally as important to me. And one's not a hobby and one's not a job. They're both careers. So it was kind of cool for 8 weeks to kind of integrate the two. And the people I was in training with never knew what I was doing. I didn't talk about it.
Really?
So I'd be in class, and we were learning how to, like, you know, fill shoe prints in with cement, you know, if we come to a crime, like a break-in or a murder scene where there's, like, footprints in the garden or in the mud, and we're out there, you know, like, dumping cement into, you know, footprints so they can harden, so we can learn how to lift them. And, you know, I'm looking at my watch, and I'm like, oh, in an hour, I'm going to be in Missouri State Penitentiary writing my horror novel, but here I am out in the sun pouring concrete into a footprint. So it was really weird to have, like, the dichotomy, you know, of the two hats I wore there when I was in Missouri. But nobody I was in class with knew what I did on the weekends. They didn't know that I went and did this.
Wow.
And there was a couple times that the people I was training with invited me to, like, hang out. They'd be like, you know, like, Alien Romulus came out while I was there, and as a whole class, they were all going to Alien Ramos, and they were like, you know, we're hitting the 7 o'clock show Friday night. And, of course, I got invited, and I was like, nah, sorry, guys, I already have plans. You know, little did they know, I was going to a abandoned, haunted prison to stay there for a week, you know, for the weekend to work on my book.
That was a lot of running around, obviously, like 24/7, sometimes getting some sleep in the hotel room. But like you said, there was no power, no electricity, no water there. So at least you got to go back to your hotel room where it's like, ah, shower time. And oh, yeah. There's a bed.
Yeah. I was there in the summer, right? I was there from June to September.
Oh, wow.
The 8 weeks I was there. And Missouri in June, July, no, I was there, yeah, July, oh, shoot, June, July, August, yeah. Those months, it's so muggy. And the air in the Missouri State Penitentiary inside the buildings doesn't leave. It's stale and it hangs there. I would be sitting there at 1 a.m. with just, shorts and a t-shirt, and just sweat pouring off of me, and so to go back to a hotel room to jump in the shower, to get under clean sheets, to sleep for 3 or 4 hours before I went back to, the sauna that was in the Missouri State Penitentiary. That was right. Really nice.
Yeah. Oh, I feel your pain when it comes to that, because I'm in North Carolina half the year and it gets so humid out there. It's like I would take cold showers and you come out of it feeling clammy and sticky, and it's like, wait a second, yeah. What just happened here?
Yeah, so. No, I agree completely. So it was yeah, so that was nice to have that, I'm at have a hotel room on the side. It was right down the street, and I'd only be gone a couple hours, because I would only leave from the overnight crew locking up to the day crew coming in and then unlocking the place, to open for business again.
Right.
So it was, it was only a handful of hours that I had to leave, but it was just enough to take a nap and shower and grab a Starbucks, an iced coffee, some Gatorade and get right back in there.
Right. Back to the salt mines, right?
Back to the salt mines. Yeah. Click clacking away.
Yeah, really.
The other thing too is I knew, so I had to come back home when my training was done, right? So my training was 8 weeks. That's why I was there for 8 weekends writing the book.
Yeah.
So that gave me a deadline. If I didn't finish the book in those 8 weekends, it's not like I could tell my job to keep me out there longer, right? My deadline was based off of the training for my work. So I was under the gun. I had 8 weekends to write this book. And there were some days I wrote for 22 hours.
Wow.
Inside Missouri State Penitentiary, there was some days where they closed at 6 a.m. because they had a ghost hunt, but the morning crew was coming in at 8 a.m. So I would just leave for 2 hours and shower and then go right back and just keep writing. And sleep deprivation, I think, affected the novel in some way. And then I had all my own experiences there. I spent so many hours alone in a cell, in the dark, in the middle of the night, with nobody in the building, writing. And I experienced a lot of paranormal and unexplainable things. And my editor, talked me into including all of those experiences in the form of a diary at the back of the book. That was kind of cool to include all the things that actually happened to me while I was there writing at the end of the book. So, anybody who picks up These Walls Still Talk, that's the name of the book. It's 100% fiction horror novel about a ghost hunt gone wrong inside the Missouri State Penitentiary. But then when the book is over, you still have another 40 pages of my diary, of literally the things that happened to me, with pictures. I also have, I took a bunch of pictures while I was there, and I included them in the back, kind of like a, montage type thing, or collage, I'm sorry. So I know a lot of people who have bought the book and went to my diary first. Read my diary first.
Cool.
Before they read the book. I want to know what happened to you while you were there. And nice. I tried to make sure there's no spoilers in the diary, because I knew that was going to happen. So I made sure I didn't talk about plot twists or anything like that in my diary. It's strictly things that happened to me while I was there writing, So that was kind of a cool little thing to add.
No, that is cool. That's genius. And I do love that, because it's like, here you are writing this horror novel, this horror haunted novel. And like you said, you're adding your very own personal experiences in diary form at the end. I just think that's awesome. I love that. That's brilliant. So you were there for 8 weeks. And so where would you say, Brian, on the property was the most active with paranormal activity? I know you said you had some experiences and we will talk about those, but my guess would be death row, but who knows?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So the two places that scared me the most that I refused to go by myself, 3D, which is the corridor underneath death row where they kept all the insane, like the clinically insane people.
Ooh.
And they kept them there until these people died. These people weren't on death row, right? They weren't lined up for execution, but the state didn't know what to do with them, so they kept them there until they died. So there's a lot of death in that building, and that floor in particular is directly below death row itself. So if you removed the ceiling, you'd be looking at the cells of death row. And you have to go down, like down into the ground. So they call that 3D, and that's number one. And then two is the dungeon, and that was solitary confinement. No windows, no lights. It's what they call cave dark or cavernous dark, right? So if you, with your eyes open, you can put your hand in front of your face and you can wave it and you won't see your hand.
And people were
down there for years at a time, years. And they threw them down there. I forgot about them.
Wow.
One gentleman was down there for 17 years, came back up blind. He actually lost his eyesight when he was down there, and he wrote a book about it.
Wow.
Which is on Amazon. Yeah, so he had to dictate the book because he was blind, right? But he spoke it, and someone, like, typed it out for him. But it's actually on Amazon. It's on Kindle. And so he's kind of, like, one of the main stories that the tour guides give about... And it's to prove how long, how torturous, and how dark it was down there. And the dungeon scares the crap out of me. Like, that's another place. I did a lot of writing in the dungeon, but only when I was with somebody. Like, I went down with either a tour guide, and they stayed with me, or if there was some guests who were there, like, there for an overnight, who were just paying guests, literally, I would ask them if I could join them when they went down the dungeon.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to go down and write. I was just terrified to. So I always waited for somebody to... If I noticed people going down to the dungeon, I'd be like, hey, you going down to the dungeon? They'd be like,
yeah, weird author guy.
And I'd be like, can I come down with you? I'll sit in the corner. I promise you won't know I'm there. I just want to write down there, but I don't go down there by myself. And the amount of people that were like, oh, yeah, absolutely, we love that. And I made some friends because of that. They'd be like, well, why are you so scared of it? And then I would tell them my own stories. They were like, oh, we don't know if we want to go down here anymore. So the dungeon and 3D were where I did not want to write by myself. I did do a lot of writing in those places, but I refused to be alone.
Wow.
And even in daylight, you know, because there's all windows. Even when the sun is shining, I still had a hard time down in 3D. There's always this feeling that something is not only watching you, but watching you from literally over your shoulder.
Ooh.
Like, it is always the same that if you spun around fast enough, you would be nose to nose with something. Like, it's right on your neck.
Wow. Yeah.
And there's been a lot of sightings down there of a lot of things, like a lot of activity, you know, down there. So it's just... It's a foreboding, ominous area. And a lot of the book takes place in 3D, like the actual fictional side of it. Because one thing I did do in my novel was every single building is structurally perfect. I did not add a staircase where there isn't one. I didn't take away a staircase where there is one in real life. I didn't add a building that isn't there. The order of the buildings are correct in the book. The number of, you know, what they call walks or levels are correct. The dungeon staircase is where it should be. 3D looks like it should. I didn't take any creative liberties with the property. I made it as authentic as humanly possible. So being in these buildings, writing this horror novel, was really helpful because if I ever forgot what something looked like, I just look up from my laptop and there I am. I'm in the building, you know?
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's right. That's right. There is no railing right there. And then I would have to, like, you know, make sure that I added, you know, describe that there was no railing on this particular part. Because at MSB, there isn't a railing there. So I was very, very adamant that anybody who's been to MSB would read the book and know exactly where every single step my characters are taking. Or people who have never been there finish the book with a perfect map in their head of what it looks like, of how it feels.
That's genius.
So that was important to me.
Yeah, no, you want it to be as accurate as humanly possible. And that's awesome because you are, like you said, right there. It's like, wait, oh, I could double check by just looking. I don't have to wiki it or Google image it or whatever. I'm right here. I could do it myself.
With my own eyes. Like, yeah. My own eyes are confirming that there's a barber chair in, you know, cell 10, you know?
So. Yeah. No, that's great. That's That's so awesome. And so I am just really excited to hear about your paranormal experiences. I know you said those two places are the places that creeped you out the most. And before we do, though, it was interesting because when you were describing the dungeon, it kind of reminded me, I did an episode on MSP like a few years back, but a more recent episode I did was on Yuma Territorial Prison. And I went to go visit that in person after I did the episode, but there was a place that was like, it was like for the worst of the worst criminals, you know, they would throw them in there. Some of them were in there for years, and rumors, a lot of the inmates said that, oh, the guards were so sadistic, they would throw scorpions in there and rattlesnakes. Oh, and, you know, because it's like not all, we're in the desert, so even in the winter, it's like, you know, it's the desert, but it's dealing with like being in the darkness where you, like you said, you can't even see your hand in front of your face, but also dealing with the rattle in the corner or the scorpions running across your feet.
Yeah.
Oh God. Yeah. I was like, okay, I know they're in there for a reason, but they don't need the extra special treatment. But some of them might.
Like cruel and unusual. I mean, that's just so awful.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah. I was like, I don't, it takes a lot for me to feel bad for the bad guy, but in that case, oh, yeah. I did.
I'm a cop, right?
I mean, yeah, yeah.
I've been a cop my whole life, and I'm a detective now. But so, I mean, you're talking to the person who, you know, sees the worst of the worst of people. So, yes, I'm with you on that. But, you know, there's a level of just, like, absolute cruelty, too, right? You know, we're protected against that in our Constitution, and I do, you know, at the end of the day, believe in, you know, people's rights and the Constitution and our amendments. So, you know, throwing scorpions and rattlesnakes into, like, dark cells is just, I don't think that's what our forefathers were thinking when they were coming up with her, you know, her justice system.
Right, yeah. It's like, maybe you shouldn't be a guard, a prison guard, if you're going to do something like that. But, you know, thank God that place is closed now. It is interesting. It's jam-packed full of history, just like Missouri State Pen. But on to the paranormal experiences there. Let's talk a little bit about some of those that you had.
Okay. Yeah, I can, you know, I don't want to, sometimes I love to talk, and then you get me talking about a subject that I love, and then you get me talking about, like, myself, and then I'll just talk forever, right? So, what I now, like, try to curb is giving away all the cool parts of the diary, right? Because then why the heck would anybody want to read it if I, you know, reveal all the cool parts? But I'll give you one specific one that is still kind of rattles me when I think about it, right?
Okay.
I was sitting in cell, I think it was 6, I'm not sure, 6 or 10. It's in the diary. And there's a barber chair in there. And barber chair was super comfortable. So I would use that barber chair to write a lot. I would go into the cell and I would write. And there was an overnight ghost hunt happening. And whenever they had ghost hunts, now the difference between a ghost hunt and ghost tour, for anybody who's listening to this and they don't understand that there's two different things. A tour is when you have a tour guide take you as a group location to location and talk about the location you're at, right? Then you move on to the next location. A hunt is that they just release you. Like, just go. You have full, you know, exploration permission of these buildings, and the tour guides are no longer really tour guides. They're just chaperones, so nobody gets hurt and nobody's doing anything crazy or, you know, hurting the buildings, right? So they kind of wander around in case there's questions, but you get to go ghost hunt on your own. You can either bring your own equipment or an MSP. If you give them your driver's license, you can borrow their equipment for free. So it was during a hunt, which means there are people everywhere. And when they do the hunt, they have a Jefferson City police officer in uniform on the property.
Nice.
As a security detail, right? In case, God forbid, a fight breaks out, someone has a gun, someone's, you know, drunk and belligerent. So they, because it's free roam, they need to make sure that there's a police officer on scene. The police officer that night was a female officer. Her name is Jansen. And I got to kind of become friends with them because there wasn't that many who did this. Their rotation was pretty quick. So because I was there for 8 weekends in a row, you know, I saw each one of them about, you know, 4 times, 5 times each, because they were there every Friday night, every Saturday night. Anyway, so Jansen was with us, and I was in the room writing, and one of the tour guides, Barker, he's a character in the book, saw the glow from my laptop, so he kind of came in the cell to sit down and kind of hang out with me. And she, the police officer, Officer Jansen, was walking by and noticed we were in there and decided to come in and sit down on this bench to get off her feet because, you know, they're supposed to kind of walk around, right?
Yeah.
And she's like, I'm going to sit down and just, you know, shoot the crap with Brian and Barker. So she's sitting there, and she is not a true believer, right? She, which is nice that this happened to her, because I love it when, like, skeptics or kind of people are on the fence when something so concrete happens to them that they almost can't refute it.
Right.
We're sitting there talking, and all of a sudden she says, something is touching my right leg, but I'm too scared to look down.
Ooh.
So me and Barker look down, and her entire right leg is gone. We can still see her left leg, so her pants, her police boots, but her right leg looks like someone took a black, like, pillowcase and kind of held it over that leg.
What?
Like, it was just not there.
Wow.
Right? She and me, Barker's like, Brian, do you see this? I'm like, I don't see what? I see the opposite of this. I see nothing. And he's like, exactly. And you saw her, like, her face kind of change. And she says, whatever is touching me, I don't like it. Could you please stop or go away? She said that and looked, finally got enough courage to look down. And the three of us saw this ghost. They call it the Creeper because I guess he's very well known at MSP. They all the tour guys see him. The guests see him. He's so well known that he's a character in my novel. And they call him the Creeper because he's an apparition that kind of crawls on all fours like a spider. And he skidded across the cell floor and disappeared in the wall.
Whoa.
Away from her leg.
Wow.
And we all saw it. The three of us all saw it. We were so terrified, and this is one of the tour guides who's 100% believer.
Yeah.
This is what he does as a side gig. He's like, and I'm out of here, and literally left.
Oh.
I mean, and I slammed my laptop shut, and we walked out of that cell, and we never went back in.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was one of two times that I saw the Creeper with my own eyes. I won't tell you the other story because that's in the diary, right?
Okay.
I don't want to keep, but that's the kind of stuff that I was witnessing there. And that was very concrete. All three of us saw the same thing. She felt it first before she, you know, she said something because she felt it on her leg. This is very weird. That was a very weird moment for all of us.
Wow, that is so neat that, like, here you are writing this book, the tour guide's there, and this police officer who is a skeptic, if you will, who doesn't believe in this kind of stuff, and gotta love it, like you said, when somebody who doesn't believe is kind of like, okay, I have no other choice but to believe because this literally just happened and I wasn't imagining it. Witnesses are here too. We all saw it. She felt it. That is, like, really cool. So the Creeper, Brian, do we know, is his identity known? I mean, 40 people were executed here. Do you think he was one of the people that was executed?
We don't know, but we do have one of the tour guides, Patrick Duncan, who's also a character in the book. I use all the tour guides as characters in the book.
Nice.
He has a picture of the Creeper on one of the catwalks looking down at guests. And it is the clearest photo anyone has ever gotten of him. He took it not while I was there. I had already written the book and left. So this is a somewhat recent photo. Well, he texted it to me. He's like, Brian, I think we got a picture of the Creeper. And the Creeper has been so elusive to everybody for so long, right? You see him, he moves so fast, you take out your camera, he's gone. But Patrick was taking a picture of the tour and happened to notice something sitting up on the catwalk looking down in the photo. So Patrick wasn't taking a picture of the Creeper. He didn't even notice him. It wasn't until he took the photo, looked at the photo, and was like, oh my God. And if you do the whole, zoom out with your two fingers on a phone and you get right up to it, it's a human face down crouched on these, like, spidery legs thing. It's the most unnatural thing I've ever seen. And this picture is weird as all get out. I almost just swore. is this so weird? But we think Patrick finally got a picture of him, inadvertently.
Right.
Not trying. The Creeper is known to, like, watch from a distance and then kind of come, like, barreling through. And, like, in my book, in the novel part of the book, like, that's kind of what he does. He shows up, there's some jump scares with the Creeper in my novel. But that's what he does in real life, you know? And so and now there's this thing, like, well, how often is he watching them, and for how long? Because this picture is him sitting way up on one of the catwalks, just kind of looking over the, like, watching them from above. So are they always being watched by him?
Right.
Is he curious? He's never hurt anybody. I mean, the worst part about him is that he's jarring, and you get and he startles you, but he's never, like, attacked, come towards you. He's always running, like, away. Like, he's always, it's almost like he's scared, too. You know, so, but the picture that Patrick has is, it's unbelievably scary. This is the thing, you know? And it's not, it wasn't a guest up there, because it was during one of the tours, so all the guests were with the tour guide down below, like
right.
in a little group. And he's like two catwalks up, looking down.
But I was going to ask if he was malevolent, but yeah, if he hasn't hurt anybody, yeah, he looks creepy, obviously. It kind of seems to like love to watch people, but yeah, it's like, okay, he hasn't physically touched anybody or hurt anybody. Well, maybe physically touched with the officer, right? But not like hurt.
She said it felt like her leg was tingly, like it was pins and needles, like it was waking up after you like lay on her for a long time.
Okay.
So it wasn't concrete, like it wasn't her being like touch, but it was like pressure against her leg with like pins and needles.
Right.
It's just weird, like a weird sensation.
Yikes. Yeah, no, that's interesting for sure. So, Brian, 40 people have breathed their last breath there when it comes to executions.
Right.
I know other people probably have died there from like suicides and other things, but execution-wise, 40 people, which is a decent number for not being Florida or Texas or any of those guys,
right.
but
right.
can you talk a little bit about some of those people and their crimes and who, in your opinion, in your detective opinion, was the worst of the worst?
Well, so 39 of the 40 were gas chambers, and one was lethal injection. So I know that that's like important, but it's still part of the history.
Yeah.
And one of the worst was two people who were executed pretty close together, and they had killed and done some pretty awful things to like children out in the area. I'm not, you know, I don't want to get into that, but
yeah.
very almost no regard at all for like kids or the age, you know, did some pretty awful things. But most of the people who were executed there, the murder was involved,
right?
Or some heinous abuse, you know, and stuff like that. So it was all pretty standard, like awful things. But there was two people who were kind of in cahoots who had done some like awful things to children for a while before they were caught. And so that's pretty terrible.
Oh yeah. No, for sure. Well, you know, I'm seeing more and more states, Brian. I'm trying to remember the most recent state, but they are actually making it where people who have charges against them that involve child, you know, crime, like sexual crimes against children, like pedophiles, that they are eligible for death row, for the death penalty. And I love that. I am a huge supporter of the death penalty, and I know that pisses some people off, and that's okay, but I feel like every single state should not only have the death penalty, but that kind of severity where it's like, if you're going to hurt our children, and especially in this matter, I'm sorry, but you're just as bad as a serial killer.
Yeah, you know, there's an old saying that says the punishment should fit the crime, right?
Yeah.
You know, so I think there's certain crimes where, the punishment, you know, crimes. There's some crimes that are just so heinous that this person shouldn't be allowed to, you know, still exist. So,
right, like their victims, they no longer exist. Right, they're not here. Well,
right.
you shouldn't
right.
be here too. You know what I mean? And so, yeah.
I want to say, so I do want to put out, this is probably a perfect time if people are still listening up to this point. we are having a huge These Walls Still Talk, which is the name of my book, event at Missouri State Penitentiary next month. Tickets tickets went on sale just recently, and they are going way faster than we thought they were going to go. We didn't realize how much interest there was on this, and there is a cap, there is a limit. It's going to be September 12th, Saturday is.
Okay.
So we are doing an overnight ghost hunt.
Ooh.
With the entire staff of MSP, who are all characters in my book, and with me. I am flying out there. We are going to do a meet and greet with me. I will sign copies of the book. They're going to have copies of the book for sale in the gift shop. You know, if you don't already have a copy, or bring a copy. The staff is going to, you know, give a tour of the property. And then I'm going to be giving a book tour for anybody who wants on of the property. So I'm going to be walking you people around to specific spots in MSP where specific parts of the book take place, and then specific places I wrote when I was there writing. And then when that is done, we are going to release everybody. You know, me and the staff are going to stay on property, but then it's going to turn into a ghost hunt, an overnight ghost hunt, like an 8-hour ghost hunt. So you're getting kind of the both worlds on this party. And it is called These Walls Still Talk. And you get a free t-shirt for anybody who comes. These Walls Still Talk t-shirt. It is such a cool design. I've already seen the design, and it's gonna be fun. So it's kind of like it's a meet and greet of the staff and me, and then it's a tour, and then it's a hunt. So we're kind of wrapping everything up into like one huge fun night for people, and we're only doing it this one night, and it's that Saturday, the September 12th Saturday. And tickets are on sale now. There is a limit. It will sell out. It's not one of these things that we're just going to keep selling tickets. There is fire codes, and there are some rules that we have to follow of how many people can be in the buildings. So there is a limit. And I'm going to tell you right now, as of last week, we were already beyond the halfway mark of selling out, and tickets have only been on sale this month, since the beginning of this month. We opened the ticket sales opened, and it was just like so this is probably going to sell out. So if anybody out there is listening is like, yeah, I'd like to do an MSP, hang out with Brian, hang out with all the tour guides, get a tour, do an overnight ghost hunt with Brian and the tour guides, you know, meet him, get my book signed, find out locations, get a free t-shirt. You can buy tickets and you can get there in two different ways. You can either go to the Missouri State Penitentiary website. It's literally, like, if you Google Missouri State Penitentiary, like, you're going to find it. But if you can't find it, if you go to my website, which is myname.com, so BrianPaone.com, BrianPaone.com, on my website, there's a, on the left side is events, it says events. If you click on events, it's one of my upcoming events. If you click that, you also get to, you know, to the portal to buy tickets. So you can get them through BrianPaone.com, or you can get them through Missouri State Penitentiary Tours, the website. So it's going to be fun. I can't wait to fly in. I can't wait to see the staff again that they spent those 8 weeks with, see if the creeper will come out, you know. So, yeah, it's going to be a really, really fun night.
No, that sounds like it's going to be absolutely epic. I wish I could go. I have so many things going on in September and October, and so I can't, but
yeah.
That is so awesome that you're doing the ghost tour, the ghost hunt, and, you know, the book tour and the free shirt and all that stuff. And so, guys, I will put I will put Brian's page link on the episode description. So literally just go to that, click it, and boom, you're right there. And no, that sounds like a lot of fun for sure. And I'm sure the creeper won't disappoint. He'll go, oh, this guy again.
I hope he doesn't. Yeah, I know. But yeah, and also too, if like anybody has any questions or they can't figure it out or they want to know more, literally, I'm easy to find because my name isn't very common. So if anybody emails me through my website, or if you find me on Facebook or Instagram and you message me, I answer everybody. I do not ignore anyone. So if you're like, oh, shoot, I want to, you know, I have a question about that ghost hunt, you know, that maybe I didn't answer just now. Please shoot me a message. I'd rather answer it and you know, and then you come and have a great time than, you know, not reach out to me.
Nice. No, I love that. Yeah, it's nice when people get responded to. I kind of, like, that's, when I had my radio show, I was very successful with reaching out to people and them getting back to me. And it's harder sometimes, like, people, you could tell they read something, but they ignore it. And I'm just like, oh, come on. And so I'm like that too, Brian. When people write to me and ask me questions and stuff, I want to be responsive. I answer them. And so they went out of their way to like reach out to you, you know, like why not return the favor, you know? And so, no, exactly. That's very cool for sure. So Brian, I want to talk a little bit, we're going to talk about your book in a little while, but I want to talk a little bit about your career in law enforcement. So it's no shocker to my family, friends, and listeners of the podcast, who I also consider friends, that I am a huge, huge lifelong supporter of law enforcement, firefighters, veterans. I've had friends and family in all of those categories, and I just love having them on the podcast. And so feel free if you mention names to change the names and locations if you need to do that. So take us on a walk, if you will, Brian, a day in your shoes as a detective.
I got into law enforcement in 2002. I'm born and raised in Salem, Massachusetts, and I got hired by my first police department, which was 2002. So I've been in law enforcement now 24 years, right? That's the math, right?
Yeah.
So 24 years I've been in law enforcement. And I started in 2002 in the town that touches Salem. It's a town called Peabody, Massachusetts. And I started, I got hired as a dispatcher, a 911 operator and police dispatcher.
Hmm.
And I have my degree in criminal justice. So that was how I entered the law enforcement world. That was my springboard into, you know, climbing the ranks. And here I am. I'm a lieutenant now, and I'm the chief of detectives for my department. But I started entry level right out of college as a 911, you know, operator, police dispatcher, working the radio, taking 911 calls. And, you know, I've taken some crazy 911 calls, like scary, you know, 911 calls, you know, where they call 911 and they're screaming for help because they're being, you know, their spouse is beating them, like, while they're on the phone with me.
Oh.
Or somebody calling. So, you know, one of the worst ones I had was they were driving and she was in the car with her teenage son and they got into a fight and she was like, well, fine, you can just walk the rest of the way, pulled over the side of the road, let him out, went up one exit. Her whole theory was to just scare him. So she went up one exit, you know, came back around the highway and then was coming back the way she had come to pick him up. And in that short amount of time, a tractor trailer had veered off the road and killed him.
No!
This was a 16-year-old kid.
Oh.
So now this mother has to deal with the guilt for the rest of her life. And that was a call I took, right? So, you know, everyone always wants to talk about, like, the policing, because I was a patrolman, you know, for, you know, over a decade. And, you know, and I've been a detective since 2023. So I've been a detective for 3 years. So people always want to know those. But we don't give enough credit for those 911 call takers.
Right.
You know, I mean, I wanted to start there because I didn't want to jump over that, because the first 5 years of law enforcement was spent in the dispatch room. I was sent to the academy from the dispatch room. So I went from dispatch, paid my dues in there, and then when a spot opened up in the academy, I was sent, and then I became a patrolman, you know, for the rest of my time, you know, up until I, you know, became a detective. So, but policing is interesting because it is a job where you can be bored out of your mind for 11 hours and 50 minutes of your 12-hour shift, and then the last 10 minutes, you are going 1,000 miles an hour with adrenaline. And so you're never prepared for when that radio, you know, keys up what you're going to get, right? When they call your badge over the radio, are you going to a cat stuck in the tree, or are you going to an armed robbery in progress, right? You never know what's on the other side of that radio. And that makes the job, you almost have to learn how not to be on edge all the time. Right?
Yeah.
You have to learn how to relax and because you can go 11 hours of a 12-hour shift with nothing happening, and then the last hour is the worst thing you've ever experienced as a cop, you know? I went to serve a warrant on a gentleman. It was in the middle of a birthday party of a bunch of 8-year-olds. He had 7 felony warrants for child molestation.
Oh, geez.
And I went to pick him up. When he saw that the police were at his door, he grabbed his 10-month-old son, put a gun to the 10-month-old son, and held it there for about 4 hours, and I was in a standoff with him for about 4 hours. We wound up getting the child away from him. The gentleman did not live. He did not make it out of that house that night alive. There was gunfire involved. And so that was one of the worst nights as a patrol, like as a, you know, police officer for me. That was... And then we had all these kids at inside the house for a birthday party. Right? They're like opening gifts. And they have no idea that in the next room we're in a standoff with this guy and he's got a gun to his 10-month-old baby's head. Now I activated SRT. I've got them rolling in. News has gotten wind of this. I've got a news helicopter flying around trying to, report what's going on. We're trying to make phone calls to all these kids' parents to tell them to come get them, but we set up a perimeter, right, so they can't go past this perimeter. And this was a sunny, boring day up until that point, right? So that was one of those police days that I remember.
Wow.
How things can go south super fast, you know?
Right. Well, once you said that he put a gun to his 10-month-old child's head, in my head, I was like, he's wanting suicide by cop. This guy's insane.
Yes. So there was a lot of thought behind that. My priority, and then when SRT got there, we worked together. Our priority was get the baby away from him.
Right.
That's step one. Because anything that happens after that, we will handle. We just don't want the baby in the crossfire. Right.
Like,
so we were not going to take a shot at this guy as long as he had that baby in his hands. I don't care who we thought we were. We were not taking that shot. So eventually we were able to actually talk him into handing the baby over to the baby's mom. So, but that was hours, but we were in there for a long time. I was in that house for a long time in this one half of the room, and one half of the house. So that was, when I think back on my policing career, like that was one of those nights where I look back on it and it could have gone so much worse.
Yeah.
So many things that could have gone so much worse,
Wow.
So yeah, he just didn't want to go to jail for those warrants because I think he knew he'd get killed in jail. Seven felonious warrants for child molestation. I mean, that's big time stuff, That's a bad dude.
And here he is at a child's birthday party surrounded by children, you know?
It was in his house.
Right. Yeah. Oh, right. My God. Wow. Yep. Yeah. Brian, I'm going to go off course for a second, but I have no sympathy for these pedophiles. I have in North Carolina in my neighborhood, not right across the street. Those are my friends, but their next door neighbors is a pedophile who loves 3-year-old children and who is as free as a bird. And every time I see him, I see red and I just like, oh, please, Hurricane, take him and only him away from us. Like these people need to be on Guantanamo Bay and be around only their kind. And that's it. Like they should not be where they could go to a child's birthday party or have a child's birthday party at their house or just horrible, vile human beings. Well, I'm glad he's gone because people like that, no good.
I mean, so that's, that was one of the bad nights of my, policing career. And if you talk to any police officer who's been in law enforcement this long, like I said, I've been in it 24 years now, they're going to have a story like that. It's not going to be the same story. Right, but everybody has that story. The one thing they remember that they take with them, where you go. That was the night that really shook me. That was the night where I, didn't know if I was going to go home that night. That was the night, I didn't know what was going to happen. It wasn't just your domestic. It wasn't just your shoplifting. We all have that moment where we go, well, and some people have multiple ones. I know cops who have 5 of those stories. Luckily in my career, that was the worst moment for me. Like that was the worst moment, was that standoff and with that 10-month-old, so that was my bad day. I've had some bad days. I've had some really bad calls as a police officer, but that's like the one, right? That's the one
right.
That I kind of put up on a pedestal.
Yeah, that's the one that like stayed with you. So that was like one of your worst moments. What was one of your best moments?
My best moments. As a police officer, we are, there to protect and to serve, and we are there to help victims. I've had a lot of cases where I was able to help a victim just have like closure. And I'm not even talking about because of like something violent. I helped this elderly woman who was scammed out of her life savings, like $60,000. And I was able to find them, arrest them, and get her money back. And so, I mean, it's little things like that, right? There's, we as a police officer through the years, I learned that policing isn't like getting the bad guy first. It's help the victim first, and then we go get the bad guy, right? I think there's like a knee-jerk reaction when you're younger and you just come out of the academy, you know, in all the TV shows and the movies, and I think there's this reaction to kind of be brawn instead of brains at first. You know, and I learned throughout my policing career that the what just happened to the victim is the worst day of their life right now, you know? And so taking a pause and helping the victim and slowing it down and getting all the facts before you go after the bad guy, you're probably going to get the bad guy faster and less people will get hurt, you know? And so over time I learned that focusing more on the victim's needs helps actually, you know, get the bad guy easier and faster, where that feels counterintuitive when you're new as a cop.
Right.
You know? And then there was this one guy, first name Eric, I won't use his last name, but I still remember it. And he had a warrant, and I went up into his apartment, and it was just me, I was by myself, and he came out of the back room, and this dude was big. I'm 5'4", 135 pounds. And I was in his house with no backup, nobody else was me. I mean, this guy could have, you know, if he wanted to, and I was like, Eric, you have a warrant, and I got to take you in. He's like, I got to, put your hands on your back. You got any weapons on you. And I was like, this guy could, crush me if he wanted to right now.
Yeah.
So he sits down on the couch. He doesn't turn around. He doesn't put his hands behind his back. He sits down on the couch. And I'm like, oh, this isn't good. He says, officer, sir, he said, my 5-year-old is in the other room playing. I told her that you're here to help me find something that I lost. I do not want her to see her daddy be put in handcuffs because I'm trying to do right by her. I'm trying to send right messages. Would you be okay if you don't handcuff me until I'm in the back seat of your patrol car? And I will come, you have my word that I'm going to come peacefully. And I had to make a decision, right? I
was
So I said, okay. I said, this is what we're going to do. You're going to go down. He lives on the second floor of an apartment building, and the stairs were outside, right? So it's one of those complexes where you come out of your door, and you're already outside in, the hallway, and then the stairs are outside. I said, all right, well, what we're going to do is, I said, you're going to go down first. You know, so you're in front of me. I'm not going to have you at my back. And I said, and I am going to have the holster of my taser off. I said, Eric, if I even think you're sneezing wrong, I'm going to tase you. He said, that is a promise.
Yeah.
And he says, that's good enough for me. And he, let me pat him down and make sure he had no weapons on him. And we walked out of his apartment, no handcuffs, no weapon in my hand. And he went down and we got in the patrol car and I put handcuffs on him in the patrol car and drove him to the jail and he took care of the warrant. And every time I saw him after that, he either waved to me, made sure he said hello to me. And then there was a time when the Taco Bell or Wendy's got robbed. Nobody knew who it was, but I feel like they were lying to us. I felt like somebody knew who had done it. And Eric saw me one day, flagged me down, and was like, you did me a solid that day. He's like, I'm going to tell you who robbed Taco Bell, but it did not come from me. I was like, of course, I'm not going to dime you out. And he told me, and it led to an arrest. And then another time, I got my patrol car hung up on a curb in the neighborhood where Eric lived. And he saw me, and he came out and grabbed a bunch of his buddies, and they helped push my patrol car off the curb.
Oh, wow.
And it all stemmed back because I just showed him a little bit of, I just treated him like a person.
Right.
I treated him like a dad who didn't want to send the wrong message to his daughter.
Yeah.
You know, and there was a trust that he wasn't going to turn on me, and there was trust with me that he wasn't going to get to the bottom of the stairs and run, or turn and fight, right? Or I wasn't going to be ambushed at the bottom of the stairs.
Yeah.
And that lasted for years, me working for that police department. Like, I know you asked me for a good story, but I tend to like to use that story because it just shows how, if we if we treat people with respect, you're never going to know what you're going to get in return. And it was longevity. Eric helped me multiple times after that. He didn't have to.
That's great. Know? No, that's a great story. And so, Brian, do you still see him at all now, or?
No, I don't. So that was the police department that I worked for in Georgia.
Oh, okay.
I lived in Georgia for a bit, and I worked for the police department there in Georgia. So I moved here. I live in D.C. now. I moved here in 2020. So that was, my old police department.
Okay. Wow. Well, yeah. But you're right. You just you made a decision, and it was a good decision. You decided, okay, I'm going to trust this guy, but I'm going to let him know that if he screws with me that, he's going to get tased. And, that's awesome that he ended up actually revealing who the suspect was for the Taco Bell robbery. And then him and his buddies helping you with your vehicle later on. I mean, no, that's neat. It seems like a little special friendship or, just a mutual respect.
Yeah. And what's funny is there's some cops in that department where, if they got their cruiser stuck on a curb in that neighborhood, everyone would have went inside and closed the doors.
Yeah.
So it's just how you treat people. You get back what you give out.
Right. Well, yeah, and that's how you also get, informants. I can never say that word, informant. I can't say that word, but that's how you get people that help you out, when you need it.
Informants?
Yes, informants. Thank you. Oh, my God. There's certain words, and that is one of them, and it's oh, my God, I hate it. Informant. Okay.
Informants. And then, the number four. Informant. There you go.
Okay. Hey, thank you. But yeah, it seems like that's what he kind of was, he helped you with this robbery and that's a really good story. I'm glad you shared that. That's neat for sure. Yeah. Sounds like he just needed a break,
Yep.
Yeah. With over two decades in law enforcement, I know you have had your fair share of dealing with not so good guys like the pedophile who would hold a gun to his 10-month-old child, and gals. We talked about a really bad guy. Is there a really bad, who's the baddest of the bad gals that you've had to deal with?
We did deal with a murderer.
Ooh.
And we were hunting him down in the city, and we kept getting different intel on where he was, but the intel kept being wrong. So we kept going to different locations, we heard that he's hiding in his cousin's house, and this is his cousin's address, and we would go there and raid the place, and he was not in there, right? But then we saw him in a car, driving while we were out of our patrol cars, and he tried to kill one of the police officers with his car.
What?
So Officer Mike Cronin, he's not a police officer anymore, he retired, but yeah, so when we finally got this guy, we also added attempted murder of a law enforcement officer to it. But instead of fleeing, right, when he saw us, he aimed the car at us and gunned it. So that was pretty heinous.
That's absolutely horrible. So this officer, you said he retired, but obviously he lived to retire. Did he make a full recovery?
Yeah, he was fine. Yeah. But let me tell you right now, if Mike hadn't moved when he did, he would have been under that car. He would have been dragged all into that car.
Wow. Yeah, people like that just need to be in a jail cell for the rest of their lives, be somebody's little prison bitch, and call it a day. Seriously, that's horrible. Yeah. You said he had already murdered somebody or some people.
Yeah, that's why we were looking for him. He had killed somebody in another county, but we got intel that he was hiding in our city.
Gotcha.
So the murder wasn't even our jurisdiction, but all his whole family and friends were in our city, so we were kind of in a manhunt for him.
Oh, incredible! Yikes! Yeah. Well, I'm glad you guys got him, and I'm glad that Mike survived that scary encounter.
Yep.
That is so cool. That sounded like an alien beaming you up. That sound. But anyways,
the sound I just made.
Yeah.
Oh, I have my Bluetooth ear pods in, and it may have been like interference or something.
Oh, okay. I thought it was like a radio, like a police scanner or something nearby.
No. I'm in my bedroom, silent in silence. But I got my I'm talking through my Bluetooth ear pod, so
oh.
It may have been something there.
Well, you know
I didn't
what?
Hear anything.
I usually edit out stuff, but I'm not going to edit that out. You'll hear it when you hear the episode. It was just like this.
Right. Maybe it's the creeper.
I was just thinking that. I was like, maybe it's the creeper. Oh my gosh. Yes, he wants to be involved. So creeper introduction right there, guys.
So
Brian, I am excited to talk about your book. So in your book, These Walls Still Talk, one of your main characters is a gal named Hannah who takes something from a haunted location, which is in the paranormal community, a big no-no, right? And many have actually done it before. And I know we won't talk too much about it because no spoilers, but talk about this character of yours, Hannah, if you will.
Sure. So, yeah, Hannah, in the book, she's a recovering alcoholic. She's been clean. She's been sober for like 5-6 years. And for her 21st birthday, back when she was drinking, her friends thought it'd be fun to go bar hop and then do an overnight ghost hunt at the Missouri State Penitentiary. Like that was her 21st birthday present. So she's really into the paranormal and all that. So they're kind of intoxicated during that ghost hunt, and they egg her on to steal something from one of the cells as a memento. Kind of like, dare you, no, you won't do it. She steals this something out of one of the cells, goes home, and whoever was in that cell, the ghost that was in that cell, is attached to that item that she took. I'm being vague because I don't want to, because there is, you know, if I say too much, it does give some stuff away later.
Right.
And she starts seeing the ghost from the penitentiary in her house now. Like, she's almost brought it home. So she decides, well, I need to go back and return it. I'm sober now. I'm clear-headed. I'm going to go back. I'm going to book an overnight ghost hunt. I'm going to be a guest. And she shows up with her best friend amongst all these other strangers, right? Other guests, as you would if you do one of these. If anybody comes to the These Walls Still Talk event, you'll see. You'll be there amongst, you know, dozens of other people.
Yeah.
All there for the same reason. And the entire book, the main plot, the plot is driven by her trying to remember which cell she took it from, because she needs to put that entity that's attached to it back in his cell. She can't just leave it in any cell because he's not supposed to be there. That's not the cell he's from.
Right.
Well, there is, in real life, a 7-foot ghost creature they see a lot. They've nicknamed him Big Boy. If you go on Yelp or Google reviews of MSP, you will see people talking about seeing Big Boy. The staff have more stories about this one particular entity than any other entity there. I decided to make Big Boy the warden because it's a penitentiary. So
yeah.
He's the warden of all the ghosts. I need a warden for my ghosts, right? So according to through the warden's eyes, one of his inmates escaped years ago.
Right.
And now the inmate is back because Hannah has brought what she stole back into the penitentiary. And this angers the warden, and the ghosts decide to trap Hannah and her best friend in the penitentiary and not let anyone leave, you know, so she can't steal anything else. So the book takes place over the course of 7 hours. I wrote it so it should take the average reader 7 hours to read.
Okay.
It was written in real time.
Yeah.
It opens up with Hannah arriving at Missouri State Penitentiary, already with the thing in her pocket, already ready to return it. The book ends, you know, as, you know, sunlight is coming up the next morning. So it should take you about 7 hours to read it, and the book takes place over 7 hours. So I wrote it as if there's a GoPro on Hannah's head, and we never cut scene.
Okay.
So
wow.
You go through the whole overnight investigation with her, with not you know, I don't do one of those things where it's like 3 hours later or, you know, like next week, you know. There's a little bit of an epilogue in there that does time jump, but that was a necessity. But the main body of the book, you arrive with Hannah and you never stop basically accompanying her through the ghost hunt with her trying to return what she stole and how ticked off how it riles up kind of the entities that live there.
I like it. Yeah, I mean, it's really neat. So, yeah, you guys, when Brian and I first started talking about his book and about him being on the podcast, this was, geez, Brian, last year, right?
Yeah. Long time ago.
Yeah. So we were talking about it, and I was able to read some of that book, and what I read, it just, like, you wanted more. And so, I mean, I'm definitely going to get the book. You should definitely get the book. So, Brian, I know people could get the book online from you, like from your, can they get a signed copy?
So my book is available. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and audiobook. And every store that books are sold in the US, UK, Europe, Australia, Canada. So the book is available everywhere, right? Barnes & Noble, Walmart, Amazon, you know, if you live in the UK, all those smaller chain bookstores, I'm in all of them. And anywhere ebooks are sold and anywhere audio is sold. So your Audible, iTunes, Spotify, if you rather listen than read. But the only way to get a signed copy of this book, the only way, there's two ways, is to order it from my website, which is brianpaone.com. All of my books come signed if you buy them from my website. I should mention that I have 14 published novels. You know, These Walls Still Talk is not my only book. This is actually, I have 14. I've been published since 2007, so I've been doing this 18 years now. So I've written 14 books in 18 years, or you see me in person at an event. I do events all over the country, book signings, conventions, book festivals, writers' conferences, special events like the one at MSP next month. I was in Kentucky in May for a weekend doing book signings. I'll be in Pennsylvania in October. So I'm all over the place. And if you go to brianpaone.com, there's that events link. If you click on that, that is basically a grocery list of everywhere I will be in person. And so if you come to an event, you get book signed. Or if you buy it from my website, I sign it when you order it. These are not pre-signed sitting in a box, and I just reach for it, throw it in a, you know, mailing bubbler and send it out to you. I actually personalize it when you buy it, so you know that this was yours, like this was signed for you,
right?
You know, because I hate when I get something signed in the mail and I just know that the artist got a box of 100 and just sat there one day, signed them all, put them back in the box, and then just pick from the box when people buy. You know, I like the feeling that I got something and the person took the extra 30 seconds.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I do that too. I haven't done 14 books like you. That's impressive for sure. But my two books, I'm working on a third book, which is about my grandfather and World War II, which is going to be a great book. But my other two books, Read in Peace, Coffin-Shaped Bookmarks, and I throw one of those in there, and I love to sign them as well for the person. But it's so much more personal. Like, people will say, oh, can I just get your book on Amazon? And I'm just kind of like, you can, but it's like, I love sending you the book myself.
Yeah, I won't stop you from getting it on Amazon, but
right.
If you get it from me, not only is it the same exact price, but you get it signed and more royalty comes to me.
Exactly. Yeah, no, totally. That's why when I talk to people who are authors, I don't say, oh, okay, I'm going to get your book on Amazon or Walmart or anywhere like those places, which is, it's cool if people do that, obviously, but that's why I'm like, okay, I'm going to get it personally from you because I know,
right,
like you said, you get more royalties than you. It's just cool getting a signed copy. I love that. I love my signed copies. They're precious to me, you know?
Yeah.
So, no, really great book, you guys. You should definitely get a signed copy. These Walls Still Talk. And if you can go to that event in mid-September, you really should go. And so, Brian, in the book, you do mention a few times the brimmed hat shadow man. Is this an actual spirit at the penitentiary, or is this somebody that you created?
So the penitentiary, what they're known for are the peakers. So much so that they have the t-shirts that say, "Don't fear the peaker." And like, "I saw a peaker at Missouri State Penitentiary." And the peakers are shadow figures that you will see out of the corner of your eye, kind of stepping out of the cell. And then when you look up at them, they step back into the cell. Or they step out of the cell and they walk down a couple cells and then disappear into a different cell. They are so common. I saw so many while I was there that I lost count. I mean, they're just the thing that everybody sees. The half-brimmed shadow guy, I needed one of the peakers to be, like, the main character of the peakers.
Yeah.
So I gave him a hat. I needed when the reader was reading that they knew it was that one that they were, that it was him that they were, that I'm talking about, and not just any peaker, because they all look the same. They're all like a shadowy figure. You know, they don't really have any distinguishing characteristics. So I needed the reader to know when it's him, because he's like the main one. So I had to do something. So I gave him a hat.
Okay. No, I gotcha.
That way there's, you know, no confusion. I don't want the reader to get confused and be like, well, wait a minute, which shadow figure is this right now? Which shadow figure is chasing Hannah? Oh, but if he's wearing his hat, you know which one it is, right? Like, there's no, so I gave him a hat.
No, that totally makes sense. That's smart that you did that for sure. Back to the Future Die Hard fans. My buddy Brian here is the proud owner of a DeLorean, which is pretty badass. So, Brian, talk to us, if you will, how it came about you getting this ever so impressive vehicle.
It's been my favorite car. It's been my dream car since I was about 6 years old. And my mother took me to see Back to the Future in the movie theater when I was 9. So I already knew the car existed before there was even a movie.
Nice.
The cars came out in 81, and the movie came out in 85, right? So, like, I had already seen one in real life, but, you know, not with all the time machine stuff, obviously. It's a car. And I remember seeing one when I was little and loving it, but not, when you're, like, 6 or 7 years old, you don't think to memorize the name of a car, like the brand, right? You just don't do that. And I never saw another one until Back to the Future came out. And I was like, that's the car. That's the car that I saw that day. Oh my god! And now it's a time machine. And I saw all three Back to the Futures in the movie theater, 1, 2, and 3. So it became my dream car. It became really the only materialistic thing I ever wanted in my life.
Wow.
You know, I never really wanted like the big house or the, you know, like the huge wardrobe or the, you know, some people, I don't know. The DeLorean was always the mecca for me. Like, I actually own one. And there's so few left in the world. And the ones that are left in the world are owned by people who are also fanatics who are very rarely going to sell them. So they don't come up very often for sale.
Yeah.
In 2007, and they're expensive. In 2007, my very first novel came out. My DeLorean, like, desire was still just as strong as it always was. 2007, my first book came out. It sold really well. In 2010, my second novel came out, and when my second novel was released, I opened up what I called my DeLorean Fund, which was a bank account where every single penny from every book sale went into this bank account, so the money wasn't coming into the household.
Yeah.
It wasn't paying, my book royalties were not paying for the, weren't paying the mortgage, they weren't paying the phone bill, they weren't paying for food shopping or gas or going to the movies. I took every penny and it went into the account. And then my third book came out in 2015, once again, all the money. And then my next book in 2017, all the money. And then my next book after that, 2019, all the money. Now I've got multiple titles that are, you know, that are selling. And my mother texted me. I was driving, and she's like, "Hey, I just saw an ad for a DeLorean. Looks like it's in good shape. Here's the phone number."
Huh.
I'm like, "You know what? I'm probably already the 100th person who's called. Like, there's no way I'm getting, but I did anyway. I did anyway." Lady told me, she says, well, you're the third caller. Third caller, and I have to go in order to be fair. And I'm like, okay, that's fair. I'm not getting the car. There's no way the two people before me are going to pass up a DeLorean.
Right.
Because you know what? You don't call to inquire on buying a DeLorean unless you're actually, you have the money and you're going to buy a DeLorean. It's not one of those things that you just like, you call for fun.
Right.
So she calls me back like a day later and she's like, well, guy number one was like trying to lowball me. Like really, he just kept trying to talk me down.
Yeah.
So I moved on to guy number two. Guy number two isn't answering his phone. I left a voicemail and said that he has 72 hours to call me back. And if he doesn't, then I'm moving on to number three, who's you? Well, I don't think I slept for 72 hours. I just laid there like three nights straight. Please. I've never wanted somebody not to call somebody before in my life that bad.
Yeah.
Right? So 3 days later, my phone rings. She was in Traverse City, Michigan. My phone rings and the area, it was not her number, because you better believe I programmed her number to my cell phone so I would never miss a call.
Right.
It wasn't her number, but it was from her area code. I still answered it, and it was her dad. Her dad was calling on her behalf, and her name was Sarah, the owner. She's like, well, Sarah told me to give you a call. You're up. And, you know, this is the work we've done to it. This is the work it needs. This is our hard price. You're going to have to get a transport here. And I'm just like, yes, yes, all the yeses, right? I happen to have enough in that bank account from my book sale royalties to buy the car.
Oh, my God. That's awesome.
So my DeLorean, my dream car that I semi-daily drive. And when I say semi-daily drive, what I mean is that I take the DeLorean everywhere except to and from work. Only because my commute is through Washington, D.C., and I just don't want to put the car through the chance of it getting hit or hitting a pothole, right? So when I say I semi-daily drive my DeLorean, it means that everywhere else I go, I take the DeLorean. So grocery shopping, the dentist appointment, to the movies, out to dinner with my girlfriend. If the dog needs to go to the vet, you know, like the DeLorean. The DeLorean is my number one car, except for commuting. But I was able to pay for this car completely through my art, through writing these books, through, you know, the first handful of novels that were published. So it was so nice to be like, wow, like my career as an author bought my dream car.
I love that. That is so badass that you were able to do that. Like, okay, all this money for the books from the books are religiously going to go into this account for this specific one thing that, like you said, the only literal material thing that you've ever wanted in your life. And you actually were able to do it. I mean, thank goodness the first guy was a cheapo. And the second guy, you're probably like, I don't wish him harm, but please be in a coma for 3 days. Please be in a coma, right. You know?
And I hope your phone's still in a toilet and you can't get calls or something. Yeah.
Right. You know, and you're okay, but your phone isn't. And okay, right. Now she came to me and now I own it. It's mine. I had enough money. Yep. Perfect. And so, no, that is really, really cool. And so on your website, you have it where people could not rent it like, oh, I'm going to take it for the day and drive it. But for events, people have been able to do that, right?
Yeah, I do a lot of events. Yep, you can rent my DeLorean. You know, I bring it and I stay with it. I have done countless weddings, graduations, retirement parties, birthday parties. I've taken kids to their prom in it. I've taken the groom to their wedding in it. I've had bands rent it, so it's like a prop outside the club. Like 80s bands have rented it. I know I'm missing some stuff. I know I'm like, we're gonna hang up and I'm remember all the other stuff I've done with it. But yeah, so I have on my website, you can rent my DeLorean. You know, no, you can't drive it.
Right.
Yes, I will drive you around in it, but I don't let anybody take you. So no, you can't rent it to take it for the day, but you can rent it for events. So a lot of those graduation, birthday, retirement, weddings, those seem to be my top ones. But another thing that I do with it is whenever I'm doing a book signing at an event that's either outside or in a building that has like a bay door, I do have my DeLorean at my booth to help attract people over to my table for my books. So I use it as kind of like a lighthouse or like a beacon, you know? If you've ever gone to a convention or a festival or anything like that, people get what's called shopper's fatigue when you go like table after table after table of kind of the same type of product, right? You're like, you know, sci-fi books, horror book, fantasy book, a DeLorean. All of a sudden, you've like snapped out of that, like, you know, that like fatigue that you get going table to table at a fair or a Comic Con. So whenever the venue that I'm signing at can hold a car, or if it's outside, I have never had the event organizer tell me, no, you can't have a DeLorean, because that's even good business on them, because then they'll advertise, come see a real DeLorean, and they could use it as advertisement to get more people to come to the event.
Right.
So the only time that I don't have the DeLorean at my book signings at a, like a festival or convention, is if it's in a building that you can't get a car through the door. You know, not every building has a bay door or a load, like I need a loading dock, or I need a way, or the front doors are, you know, like double, like double doors. So if I can get the car in, I'll get the car in and use it at my booth. But sometimes I do events at like libraries, right? I can't get a car into a library, you know? So it really depends. But I love having the car at my booth. I love seeing people get super excited. And a lot of times I turn it into book sales. You know, they stop to talk about the car, and then they go, oh, what do you get over here? Like, is this you? Are you the author? And then all of a sudden, the owner of the DeLorean, they find out there's an author, and it's a kind of a nice segue. I do have a time travel novel. It came out in 2015. That was my third published novel. So I can kind of, I sell a lot of the time travel novel when I have the DeLorean, because like, I can kind of tie it in.
Nice.
You know, so it's fun. The car's like my kind of sidekick, you know?
No, that is really cool. And that is genius that you do the time travel books as well with the DeLorean right there. It's kind of like, okay, that's really neat. I know somebody in Tombstone who wrote a time travel book about Old West, and it has to do with Doc Holliday. And so it is kind of neat, like the time travel books. It's, you know, that is definitely really neat for sure. And so, Brian, before we end this, which just by the way, guys, he has been working all day, came home and minutes later called me, and we talked a good like 20 minutes before recording this. And so it's like, it right now it's 9:12 p.m. his time.
I haven't even eaten dinner yet.
Oh my god.
I came home, got right on the phone with you.
We're almost done, so you could relax. But Brian, before we end this, I want to talk quickly about your music. So guys, the music that you have been hearing throughout this episode are his bands that Brian has been in, and he's the singer for all of them. And so talk about a talented dude for sure. So talk a little bit about the music.
Yeah, sure. So like, music is my number one love. It's, I know I'm, you know, we talked a lot about my books and my car and ghost hunting, but music is my number one love. That's, I'm just a fanatic. That's where my true love is. And I got into my first band in 1995, and I really wanted to be in a touring professional like metal band. That's what I wanted to do with my life. This was before I got into policing, obviously. This was before I even went to college for policing. I was still in high school. Well, I had just graduated high school in 95. So, you know, I became a cop. I started working for law enforcement in 2002. So all the way up until then, I was really, really working the music stuff. I opened for some well-known names throughout my tenure in my bands. I opened for Godsmack. I opened for like Mushroomhead. I opened for Faith No More, Limp Bizkit. So I and others. So that's, I didn't want to, you know, sit here and list off all these people, but you know, I did open for some bigger names. So we weren't just like a garage band. Multiple tours. We were mentioned on MTV ones. We had, you know, there was a song on the radio that they only played at 2 a.m. Like, we were hidden in the 2 a.m. slot. But, yeah, I put all my energy into, you know, doing the band thing, you know. And when I graduated college with my degree and I got hired by the police department, I still did the band thing. So I was working at the police department, and then we would tour on like long weekends, or we would play shows within driving distance on the weekends. Cause you know, I was kind of like trying to do the police thing too, you know, and the band. So I've been in four bands. All four bands have released, I have seven albums cumulatively over those you know, I'm a fan of those four bands. Like, that's my personal discography. So I've been the singer of four bands. My first band put out two albums. My second band put out two albums. My third band put out one album. And then my fourth band put out two albums. So two, 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 and the one. So seven albums make up me as a musician. And then when the book started taking off, and I kind of got deeper into policing, my most recent band that was in, Transpose, my bass player's mother got really, really ill in Iowa. So he moved to Iowa to take care of her. And she was ill for a very long time.
Aww.
And we didn't really tour. We didn't record. We didn't write anything new. Then my guitarist, you know, moved out of state. And then, you know, and then we kind of broke up, but we haven't ever officially broken up. Right? We just stopped playing. So I guess I'm technically still in Transpose, even though it's been like 15 years since we did anything. And then as the book started coming out and I started doing book festivals and book signings and speaking at writers' conferences, that kind of took over. Like, I music is still my number one love. Like, the amount of concerts, like, me and my girlfriend go to still, like, we have three concerts next week alone.
Oh, my God.
Like,
wow. People,
like other bands, right? Like, we have three next week alone. So we still go to a multitude of concerts. She's convinced that I'm going to get the bug soon, and I'm going to start looking to put a band back together. Like, she can just tell. Like,
yeah.
Every time we go to a show, I she says, I can see it in your face. You miss that. You miss being on that stage. I can see it, you know. And so who knows? You know, music is never dead. So maybe there's a band in my future again. But yes, I did in the mid-90s. Onward, up until the writing career really took off, yes, the music was my focus before the author thing. So, yes, and all those bands, if you go to my website, brianpanley.com, you click on the music tab, you can listen to all those albums and download them all completely for free. My music is out there for people to listen to and enjoy. I do not want any money for my music anymore. And they're on Spotify, YouTube. So that if you want to delve deep into listening to Brian in a metal band in the late 90s and early 2000s, that's your jam. I'm very much into bands like Deftones and some harder stuff too, like From Out of the Ashes and Thursday. And my bands, I always tended to like play that style, you know, kind of like that late 90s metal, early 2000s emo, screamo type stuff. So,
right.
That's what you're into, and my bands are for you.
That is. Yeah, so. Awesome. Yeah. And again, guys, you know me, I like to play bands that people that I know, like Liar's Handshake, Fading Point, Stick the Landing, Destined to Fell. And now Brian is going to be part of that family, that music family. This was his debut for music on this episode, and you will hear it every now and again on future episodes too. And so, Brian, again, thank you so much for taking time after a busy work day on being here with me.
Yes, thank you.
And I have a wonderful dinner and and have a good night's sleep. And yeah, back to the salt mines again tomorrow, I guess, right?
Yep. Absolutely.
Well, thanks again.
Thank you for having me. And I hope to see people at Missouri State Penitentiary in September.
Yes, absolutely. What a really neat dude, right? So glad he was on, had a blast with him. Really awesome dude for sure. And hopefully if you are in the Missouri area or just traveling through or just want to do a fun road trip or vacation, September 12th, Saturday, go to that penitentiary, get your ticket before it sells out because it will sell out.
And that concludes another fantastic podcast. Legend has it, if you don't tune in, I'll be returning to haunt you. So make sure to tune in for the next episode.
Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They're all awesome. Haven't heard every single one yet. No need to cry or lose any sleep about it. Really, not even a wink. All you have to do is binge listen to your heart's fright and delight by hitting up any of those podcast platforms such as Spotify, iTunes, Player FM, Deezer, Podcast Republic. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, everyone, and
I will see you next week.